Chapter 20 Mud Bricks and a Flood. Babylon was one of the great cities of the ancient Mesopotamian world. From a small settlement founded around 2300 BC, it grew to become the center of the Babylonian Empire between 609 and 539 BC. King Nebuchadnezzar II, ruler 604 to 562 BC, turned it into a great city with eight gates, the northern one named after the goddess Ishtar. After its destruction in 612 BC, Babylon vanished from history as a confusion of dusty mounds. The excavation of Babylon defeated several early archaeologists, including Henry Layard. See Chapter 4. They could make nothing of the decaying, unbaked bricks that remained. Then the Germans arrived and the great city came to life in the hands of a careful excavator. Robert Coldway, 1855 to 1925, was an architect and archaeologist. He was a precise excavator in the German tradition. Coldway was certain that systematic excavation of the decayed brickwork would uncover Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon. His work there started in 1899 and continued for the next 13 years. German archaeologists in Flinders Petrie in Egypt had nailed the basic organization of large-scale excavation. No longer did workers dig haphazardly into a city mound. Instead, they employed teams, wielding picks and others using baskets. They worked closely together. Coldway formalized the process, with light rail wagons dumping soil away from the trenches. Then he trained laborers for specialized tasks. He started with fired brick structures that were easily identified. Unbaked mud brick was a huge challenge, for it tended to melt into the soil once abandoned and when exposed to rain and wind. So Coldway trained skilled teams that did nothing but trace unbaked mud brick walls. He and his colleague Walter André, who was to excavate the Assyrian capital at Assur on the Tigris, found that the best excavation technique was to scrape the ground with hoes. The expert diggers looked out for changes in soil texture, or for actual walls. Once walls appeared, the workers traced them delicately until rooms were exposed. They left intact the fillings over the floors so that these could be dug later and the contents of each chamber recorded. The Coldway system revolutionized city excavation. Coldway's greatest Babylon discovery was Nebuchadnezzar's Ishtar Gate on the north side of the city, dedicated to the mother goddess of fertility. He found that the king's architects had dug deep into the underlying sand for the foundations. The walls were still intact, allowing him to uncover huge reliefs of dragons and bulls made of glazed bricks. The actual gates and the archway were roofed with cedar. In an inscription that stretches over 10 columns, the king himself made a proud boast about his masterpiece, which was also described by the Greek author Herodotus. Patiently, Coldway and others washed thousands of glazed brick fragments to free them of salt, then pieced them together. He reconstructed the gate brick by brick in the Pergamon Museum in Berlin. A paved procession street led through it to the Temple of Marduk, Babylon's special god. The Ishtar Gate and its procession street stood over 13 meters above the surrounding plain. Meanwhile, Walter André ran parallel excavations far upstream at Assur from 1902 to 1914. He adapted the Babylon approach for an Assyrian capital that had stood on a cliff above the Tigris. His expert teams traced city walls, many houses, and temple quarters. The major structure was the Temple of Ishtar, wife of the city's god, Assur. A deep trench uncovered six earlier temples on the same site. André was the first excavator to dissect a Mesopotamian city layer by layer. Realizing that excavation was destruction, both he and Coldway recorded every single building before they removed it to access lower levels. André, Coldway, and others made possible the scientific excavations at Ur and other Mesopotamian cities after the First World War. Excavations were now sponsored by national museums, not individuals. In 1911, the British Museum decided to excavate the little-known Hittite city of Carchemish on the Euphrates River in northern Syria. The excavations began under David Hogarth, 1862-1927, an experienced excavator who had worked with Arthur Evans at Knossos. Hogarth was notoriously bad-tempered before breakfast, prompting his workers to call him the Angel of Death. Hogarth's two seasons of excavation were so promising that the museum started a long-term project and chose 33-year-old Leonard Woolley as the new director. Charles Leonard Woolley, 1880-1960, was a short man with a commanding personality. He went to New College, Oxford, to study to become a priest, but while still an undergraduate, the warden of the college predicted that he would become an archaeologist. Woolley spent 5 years in the Sudan, from 1907 to 1911, mainly working on cemeteries. There he gained expertise in dealing with laborers from other cultures, learning their languages and treating them firmly but fairly. He was an excellent choice for Carchemish. Carchemish had guarded a major ford across the river until 717 BC, when the Assyrians captured the growing settlement. It later became a Hittite city, but almost nothing was known of these rivals to the Assyrians and Egyptians in the eastern Mediterranean world. More than 15 meters of occupation levels awaited excavation. Woolley was an inspiring leader, one of those rare people who are never at a loss. He also had a lively sense of humor, essential when dealing with the shifting sands of local politics and a workforce that was given to violence if dissatisfied. Respect was his motto, but he could also be firm. When a local official refused to issue an excavation permit at once, Woolley just smiled. He produced a loaded revolver and held it to the man's head. The official raised his hands in terror and said there had been a mistake. Minutes later, Woolley left with a signed permit. Woolley was a brilliant storyteller and a fluent writer, which sometimes makes it hard to decipher what really happened at Carchemish. The excavations were successful, largely because Woolley and T.E. Lawrence, who had been recruited from Oxford University because of his archaeological experience and was traveling in Syria, got on well with each other and with the workers. The dig foreman, a Syrian named Hammoudi, whose two interests were archaeology and violence, was a genius at managing laborers. He became one of Woolley's closest friends, and they worked together on several digs from 1912 to 1946. In 1912, little was known about the Hittites, except from what had been learned from the Amarna tablets found by Flinders Petrie in Egypt some years earlier. See Chapter 17. Woolley unraveled the layers of the citadel and uncovered two palaces. Stately figures of kings and marching soldiers adorned the palace walls. The Carchemish excavations ended with the outbreak of the First World War. Like Gertrude Bell, see Chapter 19, Woolley became a valued intelligence officer before being taken as prisoner of war by the Turks. After the war, in 1922, Woolley became director of an ambitious, long-term excavation at the biblical city of Ur, Ur of the Chaldees, sponsored by the British Museum and the University of Pennsylvania Museum. Quite apart from its location in a harsh desert landscape of extreme heat and cold, Ur was a complex and difficult site to excavate. A ruined temple pyramid, entire buried city quarters, and many occupation layers all presented a tough challenge for even the most skilled excavator. But Woolley was ideal for the job, being energetic and full of ideas. He was an exacting taskmaster who ran the enormous dig with a handful of European assistants and the formidable Hammoudi. The excavations began at dawn and, for the European staff, rarely ended before midnight. Woolley's best colleague was Max Mallowan, who was later to become a first-rate archaeologist and the first to follow Layard's work at Nimrud. Mallowan married detective novelist Agatha Christie, and she is said to have based some of the characters in her novel Murder in Mesopotamia on people at Ur. A trench in the 1922 excavation season yielded gold objects, possibly from a cemetery. Wooley suspected that he might be dealing with royal graves filled with great treasures, perhaps in fragile condition. He knew the task of clearing the burials would stretch his technical abilities to the limit, and his laborers would have to be trained for delicate work. So he waited 4 years before digging further there. In the meantime, he dug trial trenches to establish the city's layout. Then he excavated a small village mound close to the site. It yielded very early painted pottery, but no metals. The inhabitants were perhaps the ancestors of the Sumerian builders of Ur. Wooley had 400 laborers working under Hammudi, who was strict but sensitive to trouble and skilled at combating fatigue and boosting morale. On one occasion, he impersonated a Euphrates boatman, using his spade as a paddle as he sang lilting songs while the men cleared heavy soil. Finally, once he had cleared the royal cemetery, Wooley dug a large trench down to the bottom of Ur. At the base, he unearthed a layer of flood deposits, but no artifacts. There was more evidence of occupation below, with pottery similar to that from the previously excavated small farming village. Wooley's wife, Catherine, casually glanced into the pit and suggested that the mysterious layer could be from Noah's flood in the book of Genesis. The suggestion was a public relations dream for a dig that was constantly short of money. Privately, Wooley doubted the idea because the trench was a small one, and anyway, Ur lay in an area that was prone to flooding. But he made full use of Ur's flood in his popular writings, realizing that the discovery of a possible biblical flood would have enormous popular appeal and would help raise funds. By the time the Ur excavations ended, Wooley had cleared the Great Ziggurat, or Pyramid, of Ur-Nammu, which dominates the site today. He also uncovered dozens of small dwellings and hundreds of tablets which have thrown much light on Sumerian history. Excavating the royal cemetery was an enormous task. In fact, there were two cemeteries, one Assyrian and the other Sumerian. During 4 years of painstaking work, the excavators cleared the largely undecorated graves of no fewer than 2,000 commoners. Wooley also excavated 16 lavish royal burials. Using seal inscriptions and clay tablets, he dated these to between 2500 and 2000 BC, the earliest period of written Iraqi history. These lay at the base of 9-meter shafts, accessed by sloping ramps. The royal corpses lay in stone and brick burial vaults and were surrounded by sacrificial victims. In one instance, 10 women wearing elaborate headdresses were arranged in two rows. Recovering the delicate ceremonial objects took a lot of imagination and ingenuity. For example, by pouring liquid plaster into an inconspicuous hole, Wooley managed to make a cast of a decayed wooden lyre, decorated with a copper bull's head and shells. After months of back-breaking work, Wooley wrote a popular account of a funeral ceremony. One of those rare archaeologists who can imagine himself in the past, he brilliantly recreated a royal burial. Resplendent courtiers and soldiers filed into the mat-lined burial pit. Royal ox wagons with grooms were steered by their drivers into the pit. Everyone carried a small clay cup, took poison, and laid down to die. And finally, someone killed the oxen, and the shaft was filled in. Unfortunately, Wooley's field notes are incomplete, and so we cannot check his story. In fact, new research has shown that the royal attendants did not take poison, but were killed by blows to the head. The corpses were somehow treated to preserve them and were laid out in the burial pit. But you can forgive Wooley's use of drama and vivid recreations when you remember that he believed that archaeology was above all about people. This excavation was the last of the huge digs run by a single archaeologist that defined early archaeology. Leonard Wooley rightly occupies a place among the greatest of all archaeologists. But in 1922, Howard Carter discovered the tomb of the pharaoh Tutankhamun in Egypt. See Chapter 21. And in the end, Wooley's popular books were overtaken by the general obsession with golden pharaohs.